Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
For this special Good Friday episode, we discuss Luke's telling of the crucifixion in chapter 23, verses 32 through 49. We notice the haziness around the question of culpability for what has happened. What people or forces are responsible, and did they ever realize they had this power? We see a lot of compassion from Jesus, even as he suffers. And we wonder whether the second criminal is really any more honorable than the first, or whether he's just more savvy. More importantly, we wonder whether that matters to Jesus. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Bobby. How are you doing?
Hey, Amy. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I am enjoying the blossoming of spring.
Yeah. It's really nice to be able, after that winter of being stuck in the house with my family.
Yeah, I read somewhere that, I mean, almost across the board, stress levels go way down. Human stress levels go way down when you go outside. I mean, I guess this assumes you're not being, like, chased by a lion outside.
Yeah.
You know, we'll just make that assumption in this study. Yeah. There were no lions. But couches are so comfortable.
They're very comfortable.
It can be hard to make yourself go out, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we welcome spring, we also come into Easter and to Good Friday. And so today we are reading the crucifixion text, which is not a happy springy text.
No, it is not.
Well, so we're in Luke chapter 23. The narrative lectionary has verses 32 to 47. And
yeah.
I think we're going to extend that by just two verses to kind of, you know, it kind of stops us in the middle of a scene.
Yeah.
So we're going to add just a couple verses to the end there.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's good to get the whole end of that scene in there.
So we left off when Jesus was just entering Jerusalem in chapter 19.
Yeah.
So given that we've skipped several chapters here and some important things happen, what sort of standing on one foot, what would you pull out as things we really need to know? As we move forward.
Yeah, there's a whole lot that happens in Luke's gospel between the triumphal entry in chapter 19 and the crucifixion that's taking place in chapter 23. Like, there's four whole chapters worth of stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just had to hit the highlights, you know, you would say that the disciples and Jesus have shared the Last Supper together, where Jesus has instituted the Lord's Supper. Judas has gone out and betrayed Jesus. Jesus has gone to the Garden of Gethsemane and been arrested. He's been tried now in front of the Jewish leaders, in front of Pilate, then in front of Herod. Both Pilate and Herod have found Jesus has done nothing wrong and they want to let him go. The people, sort of spurred on by the leaders, have shouted, "Crucify him, you know, give us Barabbas instead." And so you get this kind of clear image that the political authorities have said, Jesus is not, we don't want to crucify Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The people have said, but we want him crucified. And the political leaders have kind of given in to let him be crucified. So there's kind of really interesting tension between what the political authorities are doing, what the religious authorities are doing, and then where the people get caught up in this.
Yeah.
That sort of forms a backdrop for this text that we're about to read.
Yes, definitely worth going back to read those intervening chapters. But we're not going to do that today. We're going to start in Luke chapter 23, verse 32.
All right.
Two others also who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place that is called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots to divide his clothing. So I don't know. I want to talk about this having criminals to his right and to his left and the way that the text really sort of emphasized, I don't know, sort of paints a visual picture of that.
Yeah.
How does that resonate for you, or what do you draw out of that that image of a criminal on the right and on the left.
The way that I read it, especially just in Luke's gospel, is that Jesus is being crucified as a criminal among criminals. It's interesting that this is not a unique experience. Like, we sometimes think of the crucifixion of Jesus as like the singular experience that no one else ever experienced. But even in the story, there's two other people. Yeah. And this was a kind of a thing that happened to people in the Roman world. Mm-hmm. And so this is the way Jesus dies, is in this kind of humiliating way alongside other people who are also kind of outcasts of the empire.
Yeah.
What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, it strikes me that Jesus has so intentionally spent his career among, you know, quote unquote sinners, people who have, you know, however we want to parse that out, people who have who are excluded from the systems, and sometimes because they are indeed sinning, and sometimes, you know, just because that's the way the system has worked, the social system has worked. And he's surrounded by them still in his death. But it strikes me, I mean, as we go on to read, how, like, Jesus doesn't initiate any conversation with them. Jesus is so quiet in this whole scene as it unfolds.
Yeah, I know. I think that's an interesting observation. And like it's interesting for me to hear you say Jesus is quiet in this text, because he's actually more chatty in this text than he is in the other Gospels versions of the same story. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me to notice that you think he's being quiet, because I am like, because I've got the other text in the back of my head, and I'm like, he's actually, you know, much more conversational here. And yet, you're exactly right. Even like the chatty Jesus is really quiet. You know, he says two sentences, one in this little chunk that we just read, and then one later. And then he says something right as he dies. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I think that's important, that his words are few, but the words that he speaks in Luke are important words.
So should we look at the words then that he does say here in 34? Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing.
Yeah. I have some baggage with that line, both good and bad. And so I'm just curious what it reads like to you.
Well, at first, it's like, it's very magnanimous. Like, you know, like, you would have a right to be unhappy about what these people are doing to you, Jesus. It has, at least at this moment, very little sense of suffering.
Yeah.
You know, you're thinking about other people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one of the things that always strikes me in these crucifixion stories is how brief the actual, like, act of crucifying him is. Mm-hmm. Like, you just get it in three words. They crucified Jesus.
Yes. Yep.
And so you're exactly right that, I mean, Jesus clearly must have been suffering, but that's not what the Gospels are interested in. And Luke's, I think, even more so.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, if you just, like, here you are being killed by the state, and what you say is, Father, forgive them. That's extraordinary. Do you have a sense of who the them is in that sentence?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't have a sense of it with very much specificity about it, other than the people who are making this happen. So that could be the crowds of people who called for it. It could be the people who are the people in leadership who finally, you know, gave the fine thumbs up, fine, do it.
Yeah.
Do you have a more specific them in mind than that?
I don't. I really love what you said there, because, like, sometimes people want to read that as specifically the Romans who are actually tying him to the cross. Like, people want to read that very narrowly sometimes. But I read with you that it's unspecific, and the fact that it's unspecific makes it have a broad reach. So forgive Pilate, forgive Herod, forgive the Sanhedrin, forgive the people, forgive the leaders, forgive the soldiers, right? Like, all the people who are responsible for what is happening to me, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
You know, as we're reading this, I have been studying the story of the golden calf in the Torah in the book of Exodus. And, you know, so that the people create the golden calf while Moses is up on the mountain, because they think Moses isn't coming back down. And then God is enraged with the people and wants to destroy them. And Moses tells God to calm down. And so I've been reading rabbinic sort of interpretations and thoughts about their interaction. And one thing that has really stuck with me is this question of sort of, what is God's responsibility for what is happening here? And the idea that, you know, in the case of the golden calf, well, if you hadn't left them in Egypt for 400 years surrounded by people who were you know, using golden calves to worship, then they wouldn't have done this. So, you can't you can't duck out now and say you're mad at them.
Yeah.
And I guess, I mean, one of the things that's most difficult for me to understand, I think, about this story as a Jewish reader is that this whole thing has been totally like planned. Like, this is God's plan. This is all how it's supposed to go down. So then even the thought that the people could then be blamed for doing it seems crazy to me. Like, this was all preordained.
Yeah.
So I guess this line is sort of helpful to me in that, but it, yeah, you should forgive them. They know not what they're doing. And this was your idea, God, wasn't it?
When you talk about this being the plan, there's different ways of understanding what that means. One way of understanding that is that God needed some sort of sacrifice or some sort of payment or some sort of something. Mm-hmm. And in order to satisfy God's own need, God made this stuff happen. And if you read it that way, especially, then what you're saying is really an important question. The other way of reading it, or at least another way of reading it, is to say the things that happen in this story were foreordained in the sense that they were inevitable because this is what people do, right? There is a society in which people are hungry for power, which people are protective of institutions. If you send in a prophet who says the way you've constructed society is wrong and you need to change it in ways that upset the power structure, people kill those people. Mm-hmm. And so God knew it was going to happen, not because God wanted it to happen, but because this is what happens. If you read it that way, then this line makes a lot of sense to me, because then what it's saying is, even though this is what happens, and you did this to God's singular representative, here is the conveyance of forgiveness for even for that. So I, you can tell, prefer to read it in that second way. Not that God needed a sacrifice, but that God needed an opportunity to forgive people for the worst things that people do.
Oh, I like the way that I love that last turn of phrase that you used. That's beautiful. Okay. The last little detail I want to pull out before we move on is about the casting lots to divide his clothing.
Yeah.
Ugh, that detail just wrecks me.
Say more about that. I'm so interested.
Well, I mean, it wrecks me because it makes me think of public lynchings.
Yeah.
Of like these, you know, treating the murder of an innocent person that you have decided is other in some way as entertainment and having souvenirs for it, which that, you know, that's public lynchings in American history. And so I don't know. I don't know what different church communities have done with that comparison, but I can't not think about it reading that detail.
Yeah, I know. I think that's right. And, you know, the great Black liberation theologian James Cone, one of his last books was The Cross and the Lynching Tree, where he just in meticulous detail draws out that comparison that you're talking about of the cross of Jesus and the lynching tree in America. And, you know, to answer your question, I think what white people did with that comparison forever was pretend like it was not there. And what you're saying and what Cone did and really just stark ways was to say, no, these really are. Like, if you want to be a white American or just an American and think about what was the crucifixion, lynching is the thing. They lynched Jesus.
Yes.
And you need to think, because the crucifixion doesn't really, we don't really know what to do with a crucifixion, right? But we can think about that history and feel implicated in that history. I think that's right.
All right. So picking up then in verse 35, and the people stood by watching, but the leader scoffed at him, saying, he saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Messiah of God, his chosen one. The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. There was also an inscription over him. This is the king of the Jews. This detail at the beginning that sort of the people stood by watching, but the leaders scoffed at him.
Yeah.
Who do you understand to be the people versus the leaders in that verse?
Yeah, for me, this goes back to the conversation that we've been having a little bit on the podcast. The first time I remember having it was when we talked about Jesus lamenting over Jerusalem. Back, was that in, maybe in chapter 17, where he says, I've wanted to gather you like hens, like a hen gathers her chicks, but you wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
And this sense of like the people in charge, the religious leaders, the political leaders, the economic elites, they have one set of interests. And the regular folks who are just living their lives have a different set of interests. And in my mind, that's the distinction that's being made here. Mm-hmm. And here, what you're noticing is important. Luke is starting to pull those two groups apart. I mean, he's been doing it a little bit all through the gospel, but here it's very clear. The people are watching. They're not protesting, but they're not participating either in this derision. It's the leaders who are mocking. That's how I read that. What would you do with that?
No, I agree with you. I affirm that reading. And it feels important to me that you just taught us about how Herod and Pilate, they weren't going to do this.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, I feel like that muddies the waters of who's a leader and who's a person. Mm-hmm. Also, in a way that I think is ultimately helpful and sort of true of how these things go down. It's not so easy to read this story and point to exactly who is culpable and who did what.
That's a really important point. Yeah, that's a really important point.
Yeah.
I mean, the people might have been responsible for what led to this moment. Jesus has spoken forgiveness over everybody. The people have stopped mocking, but the leaders, whoever that means, have continued on. Yeah.
Right.
It's also interesting that the scoffing in both cases involves saving, right? Let him save himself.
Yeah.
And then save yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you do anything with the specifics of that? Like, they're not just mocking him. They're mocking his capacity to save or not.
I mean, I don't think, as far as I know, that it would have been an expectation of a Messiah in the Hebrew Bible that at this point, once you have already been crucified, that you would somehow have the capacity to save yourself. So I don't know if it's based on the power that they have seen Jesus enact in the world, which has seemed at some points kind of supernatural.
Yeah.
You know, if that, I guess that's what they're looking for and not so much the, I mean, King of the Jews to me just seems so much to hearken back to ideas of the Anointed One from the Hebrew Bible. And the Anointed One in the Hebrew Bible wouldn't be able to, by the time the story gets to this point, they couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
They would have had to use their power beforehand to not wind up in this position.
Yeah.
Do you think it's referring to Jesus's, acts of power we'll go with acts of power during his ministry to heal other people? Do you think that's what they're getting at?
You know, what I think is, on one level, the expectation would have been, you know, that the Messiah was going to save Israel. Mm-hmm. And clearly he has not, right? Mm-hmm. In the
traditional sense of what that would look like. Yeah.
Yeah. What people expect saving to mean has not happened. And so on the one hand, I think this is a mocking, like, how are you going to save Israel now, right?
Yeah.
Which they mean as like a clear sign that he's not the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Then I also think what you're saying is probably right, too, that Jesus has, I mean, he's raised people from the dead in this gospel. And if he can do that, surely he can, you know, get off of the cross. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the point Luke seems to be making is that they do not understand what saving means. Like, they're thinking saving in terms of, you know, the power to
prolong your life.
Prolong your life. Yeah. To reestablish a politically independent Israel from the Roman Empire. Those kinds of savings. And Luke's version of saving seems to mean something like bringing the fullness of the kingdom of heaven into the midst of the people and giving them an opportunity to participate in it, which Jesus is in fact doing right now, even as they're saying, save yourself. Mm-hmm. Jesus is in the process of saving people, as we'll see at the end, but they can't see it.
So picking up then in verse 39, one of the criminals who were hanged there kept deriding him and saying, are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He replied, truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. So I said earlier that Jesus doesn't really talk to the criminals, but he does here. He just doesn't start the conversation.
Yeah.
Do you read this initial deriding from the first criminal as being any different than what has happened in the previous paragraph?
I mean, there are two things that occur to me now that you asked me that. One is that now he's been derided in some sense from the most important people, the leaders among the people, to the least important person, which is this other criminal who's being humiliated with crucifixion. And so the whole range of you know, I mean, it's not just the leaders here now who are implicated. It's people from all walks of life who are implicated, but not everybody from all walks of life, but
yeah,
some, like, the second criminal is going to distinguish himself from the first one.
Right. It's hard to group people together in this text because the borders of the groups keep shifting.
The other difference that I notice is, you know, previously it was save yourself.
Yeah.
From the leaders who are not in need of saving.
Yeah.
And this guy, save yourself and us, strikes you as kind of interesting because he's deriding him while also asking, like, to be saved.
Right.
I don't know quite what to do with that detail now that I'm thinking about it. What do you do with that detail?
You know, I guess I almost tie it in some ways to what the other criminal says. I wish they had names so we didn't just have to keep calling them the criminals, but
the
maybe we should
good
name
criminal
them.
And bad criminal.
I know. The criminal number one and criminal number two. Okay. You know those memes where they, like, show some person sitting in a park and they have a sign that's like, that has some statement and then it says, like, change my mind?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're going to play that game.
Okay.
Okay. Change my mind.
Okay.
I don't see the second criminal as a whole lot better than the first criminal.
What?
I think the first guy is mean and maybe stupid, but the second guy is an opportunist acting in his own self-interest. Change my mind.
Yeah, no, I see how you're getting there. And he's actually upped the ante. Like, the first guy is just asking, can you get me off this cross, please?
Mm-hmm.
The second guy is saying, can you welcome me into whatever this kingdom is that you're bringing about?
I feel like they both are like, what can you do for us, Jesus?
Yeah.
Although the second one maybe has more belief that Jesus actually has the capacity to do something. Because as you pointed out, if you really believe Jesus could get you off that cross, you maybe wouldn't start with deriding him. Or maybe you would. Maybe you think that would, like, inspire him to prove his power.
Yeah, I mean, in this really interesting way, this is reminding me of a conversation that we had about the prodigal son.
Mm.
Although I have never in my life made this connection before. But if you remember in that story, in that podcast, we were talking about how whether the son's return to the father was like a genuine return mm-hmm. or whether it was self-interested. He's like, I'm mm-hmm. hungry, I'm going to go say.
Mm-hmm.
And in that podcast, as I remember, we kind of said, like, maybe it doesn't actually matter what your motivations are.
Because the point of the story is not the prodigal son coming back. The point of the story is the father and his compassion and welcoming
yes.
the son back. Oh,
so here, the point is not whether this is a genuine return to Jesus or a self-interested manipulation of the situation, mm-hmm. but the fact that he declares Jesus innocent one way or the other evokes Jesus's compassion in the way that the father and the prodigal son mm-hmm. was compassionate toward his son, even though his son was just hungry.
Oh, that's fascinating. No, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think I'm going to have to sit with it for a while, sort of like theologically.
Yeah.
No, but like, what is it? You know, me too.
Yeah.
It seems kind of like manipulative. But again, if I can step back into the sense of, you know, when we talked about not just the prodigal son, but the other parables in that day of reading and focusing on the joy of the finder as opposed to the experience of the one who is found.
Yeah.
That does make this make more sense. Like what the first person is asking is not something Jesus is interested in doing.
Yeah.
You know, and what the second person is asking, you know, whether motivated by self-interest or not, is for that finding, is to, you know, I want to come and be part of your flock. I want to come and, you know, get better food than what I'm getting where I am now.
Yeah.
And Jesus will take it.
And I mean, Jesus was just a minute ago forgiving the people that were tying him up on the cross, you know? And so you've got this sense, I love that maybe the point here is that you've got a Jesus who represents a God who we remember from the father and the prodigal son, who's just looking for an excuse to forgive people.
Yeah. Right. Right. And all you have to do is get far enough down the road so that, you know, the father sees the son and that evokes the compassion.
Yeah. I love that.
That was a fun game of change my mind. But I think you changed my question instead of changing my mind. But I like that question.
We should play that game more often. I like that.
Alrighty. Shall we read the last section?
Let's do it.
Okay, so we're picking up at verse 44, and we're going to go all the way through verse 49, which extends a little bit beyond the narrative lectionary. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, while the sun's light failed and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. When the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and said, "Certainly this man was innocent." And when all the crowds who had gathered there for this spectacle saw what had taken place, they returned home, beating their breasts. But all his acquaintances, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance, watching these things. Okay, well, there is a lot. There's a lot of stuff happening in here.
Yeah.
Let's begin at the beginning. There is darkness in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That seems foreboding and significant.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that the natural world is having a response to this thing that is unfolding.
Would you describe this as an apocalypse because the natural world is having a response? Or do you not like that word here?
It is certainly gesturing toward apocalyptic imagery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The idea of the day of the Lord. It is not as strong in Luke's gospel. Like in Matthew's gospel, there's an earthquake and like dead bodies rise up out of the ground and start walking around. So Luke is slightly muted.
Yeah, that's slightly muted from
maybe
the
slightly
zombie
not
scene.
Even right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I hesitate to say like this is like imagery of certainly not of the apocalypse.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does seem it should cue us that some important undoing is happening.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Here.
And that sort of darkening of the sun and things like that typically accompanies God's judgment in places like Amos and other places, like the day of the Lord, the darkness of the sun. These are indicators of God, you know, coming in judgment on the world.
Okay, so we have this, you know, the darkening of the sun in the afternoon, and then that is put together in the same verse with the curtain of the temple was torn in two. So do you want to talk about the curtain of the temple? Like, what are we even talking about here?
Well, I want you to talk about that. Yeah, because I feel like you think about the temple in ways that I do not think about the temple. And so I would love to hear where you start with this.
My thinking about the curtain. I mean, the curtain of the temple, presumably they are referring to what in Hebrew is called the parochet. It's a very beautiful, elaborate curtain that separates the most holy area of the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, from the moderately holy area.
Yeah.
And priests really do not go into the Holy of Holies, but for on Yom Kippur. So the area of the Holy of Holies is really a space that is dangerous for humans. Like the level of holiness in it is sort of seen as incompatible with human contact, generally speaking. When the priest goes in there on Yom Kippur, they tie a rope around his waist so they can pull him back out if he, you know, collapses or, you know, get sort of zapped by the holiness in there. The main interaction that we hear about happening with the curtain itself, the parochet itself in the Hebrew Bible, is that, you know, when there are serious purifications that have to happen in the, you know, proverbial filters between God and the people of Israel, it involves sort of like sprinkling blood toward the parochet.
Yeah.
And that action itself sort of clears some of the gunk out of the divine human filter.
Yeah.
The image of it tearing is coming from that context is a little frightening to me. Like it has an important role in allowing the closest safe proximity between God and humanity. So if we're thinking about, you know, this sort of like breakthrough in the world and the systems as they've been established to this point, tearing the parochet in some ways seems like this like microcosm, macrocosm, you know, natural world, divine world parallel.
That's a really beautiful description. I love that. And starting to think about what is the implication of it. And is this a good thing or a bad thing or a scary thing?
Yeah.
You know, the other way is that this can be interpreted. One is that the tearing of the curtain indicates some sort of divine judgment on the temple, that the ripping of the curtain is like a precursor to what's going to happen to the temple when the Romans come. In quite a different way, you can read it. You were talking about the sprinkling of the blood toward the curtain to, you know, clear out the divine filter. Sometimes this is read as with the death of Jesus, which is in this gospel about to happen, that is no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. The blood of Jesus has sort of effected that cleansing permanently. Mm-hmm. The third way it's sometimes read is that the presence of God has now opened out to the people in a way that does not require either, I mean, it doesn't require the priest. It doesn't require the temple or the religious functionaries. God is just available, which you had described as being a little bit scary, which I think is a reasonable interpretation of that. But also, you know, now it's the way is open for the Spirit of God to pour out on the Jews and Gentiles alike in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we can really settle what Luke is trying to do with the temple curtain tearing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have thoughts about which of those is more useful or maybe more likely, but I don't know that you really can pin it down. You have thoughts about any of those?
The thought that I had while you were talking was sort of yet another comparison. You know, if we think of the parochia as sort of like the closest meeting place between God and the people, thinking about a comparison between the parochia and Jesus's body itself, and that the wrecking of Jesus's body that is happening, like the rending, the tearing of it.
Yeah.
I kind of love that Luke leaves it so open.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And we talk about that with ritual sometimes, but I think also with images like this, that like the fullness of that image may be more useful than trying to pin it down in any one specific way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that a lot. Then Jesus dies. Again, it's just one little statement. He does not cry out in the sort of agony that we hear in some of the other gospels with why have you forsaken me, but instead just a very calm, into my hands I commend, into your hands I commend my spirit.
I was reading Luke Johnson's commentary on Luke, and he cites a passage in the Talmud in Berachot. So what Jesus says here, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, is a quotation of Psalm 31:5. And Johnson says that in Berachot 5a, that verse, Psalm 31:5, is seen as a like a verse of supplication that people should say on their deathbeds. And so that this was actually, I mean, the Talmud, as you know, is later than the New Testament, but the traditions in it sometimes extend back to the New Testament period. I had not known that previously, but I think it's interesting if what Jesus is doing here is dying the death of a good rabbi.
No, I agree with you. And I'm not familiar with that tradition, but but I believe it, I guess. It seems in keeping with the traditions that I am familiar with. So.
And Luke Johnson does not mess around.
Like, I don't believe Luke Johnson.
I feel like if Luke Johnson says it, yeah.
Yeah. So should we talk about some of these responses after Jesus has breathed his last?
Yeah, I think so. The centurion in Luke's gospel, in the other gospels, the centurion says, truly this was God's son. In Luke's gospel, the centurion says, this man is, in my translation, it's innocent. The Greek is dikaios, which means righteous. And to me, that seems like a significant shift from God's son to righteous. You have any thoughts about what the centurion is doing there? Or what Luke is doing with the centurion there?
I mean, I don't have very smart thoughts about it. I guess I think of the centurion, like we met a centurion earlier in this gospel, and my main recollection of him was that they're accustomed to having some power in the system. Like the system as it is working okay for them, you know? And so to have a recognition from someone in that position that, you know, he praised God and said, this man was innocent. Why would he praise God? I mean, it seems like he would be sad. He would mourn if.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a coherent thought about it.
Yeah. Apparently. No, it's a difficult thing to interpret for sure. And, you know, I mean, you kind of flash back to Pilate also said he was innocent and yet crucified him. And so here you have another Roman saying he's innocent. So you're a little suspect about it, maybe. But one could also say that after witnessing the way in which Jesus has died, that he died with such confidence, he died prayerfully, he died trusting that he was going to be received into the hands of God, that evoked an actual like transformation in the centurion, you know, to say both that Jesus was righteous and innocent and to say, wow, what a God that must be if this man died in this way.
I think it's interesting, too, and this is sort of in comparison with the crowds we read about in the next verse, but that the centurion makes this observation but doesn't seem to feel any regret personally or doesn't acknowledge having any regret personally.
Yeah, so the people in the next verse are beating their breasts. Like, this is a sign of, I mean, somewhere between mourning and, like, horror at what they have done.
Right, a sense of culpability and guilt.
which is really important to say that these people, and, you know, we were talking earlier about how the people were not participating in the mockery while the leaders were. And we were saying maybe something's happening with the people. And here they're beating their breasts and, you know, they are upset about what they've done.
Yeah.
Which I read as contrition, recognition that they've done a horrible thing, which is the first step to recognizing who Jesus was. And maybe more importantly, to how terrible people behave in the system. Like, this is that first step toward the compassionate re-embrace of the Father.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right that the centurion does not do that. He praises and makes a declaration, but he seems not particularly bothered about it. I don't know what to do with that. Do you know what to do with that?
I mean, unless he just really, even though we can see him as a powerful person within the system, I think sometimes the way our societal systems are built, the people that have power don't think they do or claim they don't.
Mm.
So he seems happy to assume the role of a bystander here, whereas the crowds of people who probably have less power than the centurion are feeling that they didn't use what little power they had.
I love that.
The hesitation in my mind as I say that, and, you know, we didn't read through all those intermediary chapters together, but there is some sense in which it was the crowds, right? Whoever the crowds were that called for his crucifixion in the first place. So maybe that makes them feel culpable in a way that the centurion feels like he's just doing his job. Like, he's just doing what he's told to do.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But I don't think that undermines your previous point, which is to say there are all kinds of people who are implicated in the things that the state does. Some of them directly, like the people crying out for crucifixion and then saying, "What did we do?" And then some of them where people can plausibly deny that they have anything at all to do with the horrible things that are done in their name, that they even participate in.
Yes. Yep.
I think that's powerful.
Yeah.
I love the last verse, even though, like, you know, that his acquaintances and Luke is careful to specify, including the women.
Yeah.
They're at a distance, but they're watching.
Yeah.
But what I like about that is Mark's gospel ends with Jesus in almost completely abandoned. The men have all run away. He says, "God, why did you forsake me?" Mm-hmm. The women are there watching, but in the very next story, they run away in fear.
Yeah.
So you end Mark's gospel with the sense that Jesus had nobody. Luke's gospel is so different in that God receives Jesus, or at least Jesus anticipates God receiving him into God's hands. The acquaintances are there. The people are there. The women are there. Mm-hmm. Jesus has a community in this gospel in a way that, I mean, I don't know. I just really like it.
No, I mean, I think, yes. And there are people who are immediately acknowledging that something important just happened and something that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Very different than Mark. Okay, my friend, we have come to the end of our text, and I will ask the question we ask each week. What is a message that you would pull out for folks today?
I mean, that question feels particularly weighty when the question is like, what is the message you take from the crucifixion of Jesus?
Indeed.
Yeah.
You have 30 seconds. No.
There are two things that are really sticking with me from our conversation today, which were not necessarily the two things that I thought were going to stick with me. One of them is that this text is recognizing that people do horrible things.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the way we were talking about, like, some of the people immediately realized they had done a horrible thing and they beat their breasts and they're upset about it. Some people, like the Roman centurion, seem to recognize that a horrible thing has happened, but they are somehow inoculated from it. They don't recognize their own participation in this, so they're not properly upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, there's sort of a conviction there, like, you too, Williamson, do terrible things and you participate in terrible things. This is what people do. And you can either recognize that about yourself and you can find ways of expressing that and trying to do something different, or you can not. You can be the criminal who is self-interested and just looking out for himself. You can be the criminal who recognizes the innocence of Jesus and, you know, at least, like, does your best to separate yourself from that system. So to me, that's the first thing, is this crucifixion of Jesus exposes what human systems do to people who challenge the systems even the innocent, and we need to be real about that. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I had not thought about before today, but I really love where we landed, was that this telling of the story seems to be emphasizing how, like, God is looking for an excuse to compassionately receive you back into the fold. And it, in some sense, doesn't quite matter what your motivations are. Mm-hmm. In some way, if you can just recognize that there is something that needs reconciliation here, God is just waiting to put that back together. Jesus is forgiving people on the cross and, you know, welcoming people into paradise. And, you know, your motivations mm-hmm. don't have to be entirely pure. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get it exactly right. You just have to open your eyes and see what's going on. And to me, that's a really encouraging message out of what's a really pretty horrifying text.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
What do you see? I mean, it's so interesting to think about the crucifixion of Jesus from outside the Christian tradition. I'm just so curious about what you're seeing in this text.
You know, when I encounter biblical texts that are really awful in a way that I would describe, you know, watching the suffering of this person on the cross as awful, the best I can do usually is to try to use it as an impetus to force me back into the world to see where this thing is still happening.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I can't use my power to change something in this story, but I can use my power to change something that's happening in the world right now. And I imagine that there is a temptation to really find the meaning of this story in the singularity of this episode.
Yes.
But as you were saying also, almost the very fact that there are all these quotations from the Psalms in here, if we're going back to the ancient world, in some ways it's a singular experience, fine. But it's also not. Like,
yeah.
It is an experience that sense of abandonment and the degradation of a suffering person's humanity and public humiliation and, like, all of that have been going on since time immemorial, not only to messiahs, but to ancient people and to modern people. And,
yeah.
You know, the connection to modern day lynchings and, you know, in America and, you know, to the African-American community, but also around, you know, everywhere. Like,
yeah.
As you were saying, like, people do terrible things. And I think if we can find motivation from some of that distress, I think we should feel distress reading this story. And if
yeah.
we can use that to push us back into the world and say, where is this happening where you can do something
yeah.
to prevent it, then, you know, that's the power of putting it in a sacred text, you know, is that it holds it up and it makes you see this should not happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a way that should send us all back into the world
yeah.
to make it stop happening.
I love that. And it brings me all the way back to where we started, where we were talking about the temptation to skip the crucifixion mm-hmm. in the podcast and in
yeah.
the liturgical seasons of the church, and how much you lose about exactly what you're talking about, the capacity of this text to push us back into our own world and see where does this keep happening and how are we implicated in it. And if we skip from triumphal entry to resurrection, which we are tempted to do,
yeah.
many of us anyway, we miss all of that. It's easier to skip all of that, but it's crucial not to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whew. Well, all right. So next time, the story will continue with the resurrection, which I think will be all the more meaningful because we read through the crucifixion.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about that text with you.
All righty, my friend. Be well. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us again for our Easter episode when we'll be discussing Luke chapter 24, verses 1 through 12. Until then, keep on digging.